everybody, and welcome to the Frontside Podcast, episode 69. My name is Charles Lowell. I'm a developer here at the Frontside and your podcast host in training. With me is Will Wilsman, also a developer here at the Frontside. Hello, Will.
Hello.
And today we have a special guest, an actual elite member of the Three Timers Club, counting this appearance. So we have with us Torin Billups. Thank you for coming on to the show today.
Absolutely. I'm not sure how the third time happened, but I'll take it.
Well, this is going to be the second one. We're going to be talking about Redux. And then I believe you were on the podcast back in 2014 or 15.
One of our
first episodes. So make sure to get in touch with our producer afterwards to pick up your commemorative mug and sunglasses to celebrate your third time on the show. So awesome. I'm glad to have you. We actually tend to have people back who are good podcast guests. So
well, thank you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this one. So this is actually a continuation of a podcast that we did back in January that was actually, you know, one of our more popular episodes. And so there was, you know, a big demand to do a second part of it. And that podcast, we talked about the Ember Redux library, of which you're a maintainer, and just kind of working with Redux in Ember in general. So we're, you know, going to kind of continue where we left off with that. But obviously that was what? Almost 6 months ago. So I was wondering, maybe you can start. Have there been any kind of new developments, exciting things, or just kind of what's kind of the state of the state or the state of the reducer or the state of the store in Ember Redux?
Yeah. So for Ember Redux in particular, you know, we're working on kind of three initiatives right now. The first is making the store creation more customizable. A lot of people that come from the React background in particular are very used to handcrafting how the store is put together with the right middleware and enhancers and reducers. And that's been fine. I sort of wanted to drop people into the pit of success and everybody's cool with that. But now we're getting to a point where there are people wanting to do different things. And it's great to open the door for those people if they can while keeping it very simple. So we're working on that. We have a PR up that's just undergoing some discussion. We're also, just as like the wider Ember community, you guys may be involved in this as well, trying to get the entire stack over to Babel 6, the Ember CLI Babel 6.10 plus stack. There was kind of a breaking change between Babel 5 and 6. So we're also kind of having some discussions about the Ember Redux 3.0 version bump at some point later this year, just because we really can't adopt this without introducing basically a breaking change for older Ember CLI users.
So just in general, this is a little bit off topic. What does it mean to go from Babel 5 to Babel 6, you know, if I'm an add-on author?
Yeah, I would probably, in truth, need to speak more with Robert Jackson about this. He and I just kind of went back and forth because I thought I had a kind of Babel compile error. And he was like, no, you're missing this dependency, which is the object spread. And unfortunately, the object spread is kind of rampant in React projects. And it's totally cool. So I had to actually add that. And that's kind of just a breaking difference between these two. So if we adopt the new version of this, then the shims underneath of it as an Ember 2.43 user, if you're on node 4, which is still supported, you will break without this. And so I'm trying to get some discussion going around what we should do here. And if we even should push ahead and just say only node 6 is supported. So there's some discussion. And then back to your original question, the third piece is we've introduced the ability to replace the reducer, but we need to get some examples up for hot reloading the reducer. And that's kind of a separate project, but it needs to be enabled by Ember Redux. So those are kind of the three main initiatives. Yeah.
And so like being able to hot load your reducer is just, you know, you make changes to your reducer and you just thunk them into the application without having to, you know, lose any of the application state. So, and that's one of the reasons that's possible then is because your reducers have no state themselves. They're just pure functions, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, awesome. That sounds like there's a lot of cool stuff going on. So, you know, beyond Ember Redux, are there any kind of developments to look for on the horizon in the wider Redux community that might be coming to Ember soon?
Yeah, actually one of them. It's actually fairly new and it's already in Ember, just because I've already got a shim up for it, is Redux Offline, which I remember you had Alex on an episode or two ago about sort of breaking your brain around Rx. And I feel like that happened for me trying to build apps offline first. And this is, of course, just sort of another library you can drop in that plays nicely with Redux. But I feel like the community, and at least it's gotten me thinking now about what do apps look like that would really disrupt someone who's a big player today. And I feel like if you built a great offline experience with true and well done data syncing, you could really step in and wreck someone who's kind of in the space today.
Right. So this is a shim around, what was the name of the library again?
Redux Offline.
Okay. And so it's just tooling for taking your store and making sure that you can work with your store if you're not actually connected to the network and like persisting your store across sessions, or how does it?
Yeah, it has uses a library underneath it called Redux Persist that takes care of kind of just hydrating the store, of course, if you have no network connectivity. But it also is beginning to apply some convention or pattern around how to retry and how to roll back. And it's just an interesting look at the offline problem through the lens of an action-based immutable data flow story. So it's kind of interesting. I don't have a ton of experience with that. I kind of tweaked and rewrote my Yelp clone with it. And that was tough. Like that's mostly what I mean by this is like, I thought this would be very trivial, but you have to do a lot of optimistic rendering and then sort of optimistically gen primary keys that get swapped out later. And it's just kind of tricky. If you've never done offline first, which I have not, I just think offline is pretty cool. And along those lines, there's been a lot of discussion around convention. There's, of course, Create React App, which is kind of like a little library or CLI tool to kick off your Redux and React projects. It's kind of like Ember CLI, a very trimmed down version of that right now. And that's just getting incrementally better. Of course, you guys are in the React space, so you may touch upon this or if you haven't already.
All right. So, you know, we talked at a very high level, I think, the last time we had you on the show, but kind of wanted to, you know, now that the idea is gaining traction, kind of delve into more specifics about how you use Redux in Ember. And, you know, I asked at the end of the last podcast, let's step through a use case. Like, what would deleting an item look like in, you know, Ember Redux land? And maybe we can pick that up like right now and just kind of understand how it all connects together.
Yeah, absolutely. Without understanding how this entire flow or this event bubbling happens, it's kind of hard to get your head around it. The process we're going to walk through is exactly that use case you laid out, Charles. We're going to have a button in our component, and that button on click, the idea is to remove an item in a list that we happen to be rendering, let's say. So if this is a child component, like the very primitive, literally button that you have, and you're just going to have your on click equal probably a closure action in Ember, the parent component or the outer context is going to be responsible for providing the implementation detail for this closure action and what it does. This is kind of the meat of what you're getting at. So the high level here is there is a single method on the Redux store that you have access to. It is called dispatch. And the nice thing about Redux, again, the API surface area is very small. There's just a very handful of methods you need to get your head around. This one in particular takes one parameter, this dispatch method. That parameter is a JavaScript object. Now, if this is you just playing around, you just want to kind of see the event flow up, there's only one requirement asked of you, and that is a type property. So this JavaScript object has a type that is often a string, so it's very human-friendly. You can just put in there as a string, remove item, let's say. Now, of course, you want to remove a particular item. In this remove example, you, of course, want to pass some information as well beyond the type. The type is mostly just a Redux thing to help us identify it. But in this case, you'll definitely know the primary key or the ID value, let's say, of the item you want to remove. So in addition to type, this JavaScript object, let's just say, has a ID property. And that can come up from the closure action somehow if you want. So once you click this, what's going to happen is you're going to fire this closure action. The closure action is going to invoke dispatch with the JavaScript object. And dispatch is going to run through the reducer, which is the very next step. And what we do is we take the existing state. So let's say we have a list of three items. That's going to be the first argument now in the reducer. And the second argument is this action, which is just, as I described it, a JavaScript object with two properties, type and ID. So you can imagine an if statement, conditional switch statement that says, hey, is this the remove item action? Ah, if it is, okay. We have the ID of the item we want to remove. And since we have a dictionary where the primary key of the item is the ID, we can just use lodash omit. And we basically use omit to filter out the ID and then use object assign to transform or produce a new state. And then a callback occurs after this that tells your list component that's somewhere in your Ember tree to re-render, now only showing two items.
So one of the things that I wanted to point out there, you just touched on it, but I think it's an interesting and subtle point, is that the method, the lodash method that you used was omit, and that how, you know, this is kind of tangential, or maybe I would say parallel to programming in this way, is that you don't actually use methods that mutate any state. you calculate new states based on the old states. And so I think that's a great example of that, that omit function. You know, omission is the way that you delete from something in an immutable fashion. You're actually filtering, or you're returning a new copy of that dictionary that just doesn't have that entry. You're just omitting it. You're not destroying the old one. You're not deleting anything. You're not changing it. You're just kind of Xeroxing it, but without that one particular entry, which is kind of ironic because the effect on the UI is that you have done a delete, but really what you're doing is omitting there. And, I just think that's cool. I think it's one of the ways that, you know, using these systems kind of teaches you to think about identity differently. And then the question that I wanted to ask you was, so this all happens in the reducer. What does that mean? What does that word mean, reducer? Like, I've kind of like danced around that idea, and I've kind of tried to like understand where that term came from and how it helps give insight into what it's doing. And I come up short a lot. And so maybe we can, you know, try and, if we can't explain what the name of reducer is, try and like, maybe there's some alternate term that we can help come up with to aid people's kind of understanding of what is the responsibility of this thing.
Yeah, I think we can just break down reduce first, and then we'll talk about how it ends up looking. But I think of reduce almost like it's defined in the array context. So if I have an array of 1, 2, and 3, and I invoke the reduce method on that, we actually just produce a single value, and sort of flatten it out and produce a single value as the result of that. So 3 + 2 + 1 = 6 is that end result.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've glossed over this entire time, probably the last episode as well, is that this reduce word, I believe, is used because in Redux, we don't really just have one massive or monolithic reducer for the entire state tree. We instead have many small reducers that are truly combined to do all the work across the tree. So my mind is, I think reduce kind of fits well here because we're actually going to combine all these reducers and they're all going to work on some small part of the state tree. But at the end of the day, we still have just one global atom, and that's the output. We want one global atom with a new transformed state, and that is the reduced state.
So you take some set of arguments, one of which is the prior state, and you reduce that into a single object. I like that. You know, the other place where I've seen this term applied in a similar context is in Erlang. They talk about reductions so that you have an Erlang server where you have a set of the way that the server is modeled is as a recursive function call where you pass in the prior state of the server plus any arguments. If you're handling a request or something like that, you know, bundled in there is going to be the arguments of the request. And then what that function returns is a new state, which is then used to pass in to the next state. And they call this process reduction. You know, we've got two data points. Maybe there we can go search for the mathematical foundation of that later.
I like it.
If we want to geek out. But I think that, okay, I think that helps. I think that helps a lot. Essentially, this action, to kind of sum up the responsibility of the action, is you take a set of arguments. It's going to take the existing state of the store, run it through your reducers, and then it's going to set the next state of the store or yield the next state of the store. Is that a fair summary of what you would say the responsibility of the action is?
Yeah, I think you're right. In fact, in preparation for this talk, I just threw together a really small Ember twiddle that we'll link in the show notes that I call the mega, you know, trimmed down version of Ember Redux. And it's basically a really naive look, but for conceptualizing this flow, it's about 24 lines of code that show exactly what you're saying, which is I have this reducer. It's passed into this create store method, you know, in the syntax. So how does this actually look? And it kind of, it better illustrates how the reducer is used when dispatch is invoked. So dispatch, if I was to actually walk like line by line through this, which would be probably pretty terrible, but the very first line of dispatch is to just call the reducer. And from that new state transformation, we just push in. So the store sort of gets a new entry into its array of, hey, here's the next state. And because we had never tampered with or side effected the old state, we could easily go back in time just by flipping the pointer in the array or that index in the array back one.
Okay. So then I guess my next question is, we've talked a little bit about immutability, and we know that this reducer, you know, that we call at the very first point of the dispatch, you know, is a pure function. And so we're dealing with pure functions, immutable data. How do we actually, but at least in perception for our users, our system is going to have a side effect. You know, there's going to be calls to the network. There's going to be, you know, we are, at least in theory, deleting something from that list. How do you go about modeling those side effects inside Redux?
Yeah, this is a great intro because, in fact, a friend of mine, he's actually a teacher at a boot camp, and he was telling me the other day that he was asked to do a sort of brief look at Redux. And his very first feeling when he was watching some of the Egghead IO videos is like, oh, so the reducer is pure, but I have to like side effect something. So where do I do this? It's not very clear, I think, for the very beginner, which is why we left it out of that part one podcast. So today we'll kind of hit that head on. But before we get into that, let's kind of talk about what having actions in their simplest form look like today in your Ember app. So as I mentioned earlier in this remove example, you got the button. It just takes the closure action, the on click, right? No big deal. The bigger work was on the parent context or the parent component to provide this action, right? Which sounded very simple, but imagine instead of just dispatching synchronously, which is kind of what we talked through, imagine, oh, we only want to dispatch that officially to change it if we have gotten a 204 back and the fetch request has deleted it on the server, right? Normal AJAX or fetch type flow. And in this case, you start to add a little more code, right? And imagine for the moment, this is all inline in your component.js file. So the component now is starting to take on an additional responsibility. In addition to just providing a simple dispatch that says, hey, go remove this Mr. Reducer later, you're now starting to put some asynchronous logic. And as you imagine a real application, you grow some try catch stuff, some error handling, some loading, some modals. This gets out of hand. So one of the things that I want to touch on briefly is, you know, we ship, at least in the Ember Redux case, we ship this promise-based middleware. And I want to stop right there for just a second because I use that word middleware and immediately we got to at least highlight what this is doing. So in that pipeline we talked about earlier, right? In the component, I dispatch and it just goes right to the reducer. Well, technically, there's actually a step or an extension point right before the reducer is involved. And that is where middleware comes in. So technically, you could dispatch from this action and then you could handle and do the network IO type request in middleware instead, then forwarding on another dispatch of a different type with the final arguments to be transformed. And that's really the role.
Can middleware actually dispatch its own actions?
Correct. Yep. In fact, that's one of the first big differences between this example. I'm kind of hacking around the component, right? And I've got access to dispatch. But there's two things I'm really actually lacking if I don't leverage middleware full on. The first is I do have some state, right, in the component. But often it's actually just the very small slice of state that this component renders. So if there's actually a little bit more information I need or I actually need to tap into the full store, I don't have it. And that might be considered a good constraint for most people. But there are times you imagine more complex apps. You need the store. You might even just need a little bit more state. Middleware provides that as where you're kind of trapped with just that slice of state and dispatch the keyword. That's about it in the component. But the other side effect or other benefit as you break this out is you get another seam in the application where the component now is not involved with error handling and promises and async flows or generators. It just does the basic closure action setup and fires dispatch almost synchronously like it did in our very simple example, allowing the middleware to actually step in and play the role of, okay, I'm going to do a fetch request or I'm going to use a generator. It's almost like the buffer for IO or asynchronous work that it was missing in our original equation. Imagine you want to debounce something. Or you want to log something, or you want to cancel a promise, which you can't do, you know, any of that sort of stuff. That's going to happen in this middleware component. So that's one of the things I like about middleware as I learn more about it. And the moment you get to a very complex async task where you actually are doing the typical type ahead, where you literally want to cancel and not do the JavaScript work, or you would like to cancel the promise as quickly as you can very quickly dive into something kind of like what you and Alex talked about with Ember concurrency. And the Redux land, it's called Redux Saga. It's just generator-based async work.
Has Saga kind of emerged as the async library that everybody uses? I know it's very popular.
Yeah.
Okay.
And good reason. I mean, it solves a lot of the problems that if you were to try and do the, cancellation token promise stuff that came out a while back when we were trying to figure out how to cancel promises, there's a lot more ceremony and just a lot more state tracking on your own that generators and even what I played with this last week, which is actually Redux Observable, which is an Rx-based middleware. It's kind of built by, I think, Ben Lesh and Jay Phelps from Netflix, Jay is still at Netflix. But anyway, so you could use Rx, you could use generators. This really is just the escape valve for async and complex side effect programming that can't or shouldn't take place in the reducer because it's pure. And it shouldn't take place necessarily in the component because one of the best pieces of advice I got when I was younger was Torin, make sure you do or delegate. And we're talking really about levels of depth in your methods, right, at the simplest. But it applies here as well, which is I would love it if I had just a very declarative component and I didn't have to get into the weeds as I was looking at it about exactly, is this a promise? Is this a Redux thunk, as they call it? Is this a generator or is it Rx? I don't even care in the component for the most part. I just need to know the name of the action and the arguments. If I care, if I'm having a problem with the Rx side or the generator, I'll go into the middleware and work from that particular abstraction. But you can see the benefits of a seam there. But
so are the middlewares match on the action payload in the same way that the reducers do? Is that fair to say?
That is fair. And I will warn, if that seems very strange, you're probably not alone. In fact, the first time I did this with Redux Saga, I was like, so I'm dispatching only to turn around and then dispatch again. It feels very strange the first time. But again, keeping in mind that you're really trying to have a separation from the work that is side effect and the work that is pure. So the first action in that scenario, let's say just remove, you know, we'll call it remove Saga because it's actually going to fire something to a middleware. That work is all going to be network heavy and is not really as easily undo redo because it's not pure. But the second event invoked from the actual middleware itself that says remove item, here's the ID, we're good. That work could be undone, redone all day, right? Because it hits the reducer, which is pure. Right. You can in and out. So
it sounds like, you know, basically the middlewares allow you to kind of have a branching flow structure because they all do involve more actions getting dispatched back to the store to record any bookkeeping that needs to happen as part of that. So, you know, if you want to set some spinner state, you know, that'll be an action that gets dispatched. But in terms of like sync with, they kind of allow you to set up sequences of actions. Or if you have one action that will be resolved, will actually get resolved as 10 actions or something like that. You know, like if you think about an asynchronous process, you know, you have the action that like starts it, but you know, you might actually, that might end up being composed of 5 different actions, right? I want to say like, I want to set the application into some state that knows that I've started my delete. And that means I want to show like the spinner. And then, you know, at some later point, I might want to show progress. Like, boy, this delete's really taking a long time. And I might want to just dispatch 5 different actions indicating each one of those little bits of progress. And then finally, I might want to say it's done or it failed. So really, those got kind of decomposed into like 10 actions or 5 actions or whatever. And so the middleware is really where you do that, where you kind of decompose high-level actions into smaller actions. Or it's one of the places.
Yeah.
Is that a correct understanding?
Yeah, I think if you're an old school developer for a minute, we'll cater to the audience that maybe came from early 2000s back-end dev. Now they're still pretty current in web dev. This would be, and I see it talked about as business logic. I feel like this is really the bulk of the complex work, especially if you're using Rx. You're actually creating these declarative pipelines for the events to flow through. And I feel like that's the bulk of it. My components are much thinner by comparison, right? They're truly just, hey, fire off this action with the information to kick the async pipeline. But in the async piece of it, there's a lot more work happening. And that's, I think, because there's a lot of complexity in async programming. So,
right. And it's almost like with the reducers, then there's not so much business logic as you're just kind of resolving the implications of the new state. Is that fair to say? It's like, now that we've got this information, what does this imply directly?
Yeah, I think there was like this old DHH thing, right? You know, where everybody's talking about what should be, you know, thick, you know, thick controllers or thick models, what should it be? And of course, we never want thick anything is the right answer, I think. But I do like the apps I'm building today. I feel like if any was thicker, you know, a measure of degree bigger in effort or work, it is these middleware components right now. And that's just, I think the nature of what you described, which is the reducer is not supposed to be doing anything complex. It's literally taking a piece of data in, producing a new piece of data out, like logically thinking about that. Takes much less effort, I think, than the human brain applies to async programming in JavaScript.
Right. I think it makes sense. But and some of these things are just going to be necessarily gnarly and hairy because that's where the system is coupled. Like you have, I can't say anything about whether the delete succeeded or failed until I've actually fired off the request. Those are implicitly sequenced. There has to be some glue or some code declaring that those things are sequenced. And so, you know, that has to be specified somewhere. Whereas, you know, theoretically, right, with your reducers, you could just run them all in parallel, even like if, you know, if JavaScript supported multi-threading, like there's absolutely no dependency between those bits of code.
I think so. Yeah. I think there's still some challenges because in the reducer, sometimes we can talk about this in a few minutes, but you may actually be changing several top level pieces of the tree at this, you know, if you're denormalizing, which is what we probably should touch on next. But so there are some cases where you want to be a little careful, but I think, like you said, generically immutable programming enables multi-threading, right? We're not touching the same piece of state at the same time.
Right. As long as a piece of state that you're touching is not being, like, you need to resolve the leaf nodes of the tree first, but any siblings, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah,
on
yeah.
There ought to be able to be resolved in parallel. And it's more an exercise in theory or just a way of thinking about it, because, like, why you're able to do those reducers as kind of these pure functions is because, right, there's no dependency between them. Whereas, like, I guess I'm just trying to point out that, you know, wrap my head around, there are places where there are just clear sequences and dependencies. And those are kind of things that would be in a middleware.
Gotcha. I was less familiar. I'm a little scared of service worker in some ways, but.
So yeah, that's actually a great point, is what kind of is the analogous, if there is anything analogous in Ember today, that's kind of fulfilling the role of middleware. And what's the migration path, or what's the alternative? Just kind of trying to explore, like, where you might be able to use these techniques that we've been describing inside your app.
Okay, yeah, I think it's at least my look at it has been a service injected into a service, which sounds completely bad, or it sounds broken the first time you see it, because you're like, we're injecting a service into an existing service. But I say that because, for me at least, there is a top-level service that owns the data and provides read-only attributes, right? But there should be some other piece of code, not the component, that is doing this asynchronous complex processing we just talked about as middleware. That is often a different service than the service that owns the state atom. So that's what I meant by service injected. There's some Ember service whose job is to manage the complexity that has probably ended up in middleware from a Redux perspective. Or Ember concurrency is literally solving that, in my opinion. Like, they do a lot for you solving the async problem generally. And I haven't dug into Ember concurrency enough to know, you know, the pipeline stuff, I think, which you guys talked about, which is an RFC, that may eventually be what I consider like the RX or Redux saga middleware today.
Right. I think so. Ember concurrency is just absolutely fantastic, but it is a hairy problem, but there's some overlap in terms of what it's solving. I think that is interesting. I guess it would, so a case where you would use middleware would be anywhere that you would use Ember concurrency. I think that the interesting thing to kind of compare and contrast there then is one of the kind of maybe advantages or disadvantages, let's just call it a trade-off, is that with Ember concurrency, you have this middleware is associated with a object. It's associated usually with a component or a route. So when things happen to that component, you're able to affect your Ember concurrency process. But it does mean that these things are kind of sprinkled throughout your application, and there's, you know, the rules that are governing them can be really different depending on which part you're operating in, or just, you know, because sometimes you're using them on a route, sometimes you're doing it on a component. I guess you could, sometimes you're doing it on a service. Whereas, you know, with putting in the middleware, it sounds like they're going to all be in one particular place. All right. So let's move on from the simple to the more complex, because that's where it's at, right? You know, we've talked about modeling async processes. We've talked about, you know, handling state transitions and all that. You know, nothing kind of typifies that more profoundly in the Ember community than Ember data as kind of, yeah, just a foundation for state and syncing it over the network. And you know, love it or hate it, it is, you know, it's very popular. What are the kind of things that you do in Ember Redux land? One is, like, is it fundamentally incompatible with Ember data, or is it just, you know, more easily served with other alternatives? Or how do you kind of handle those foundational interactions, kind of those fun foundational async loading network interactions with Ember data, just using Ember Redux?
Yeah, myself, I don't have any experience actually using the two together on purpose. There is a gentleman who did a talk sometime last year, and I'll dig up the YouTube clip for you guys, where he kind of talked about his approach, where you would actually produce new states, so it was still Redux friendly. Ember data itself would just be a new Ember data model every time you transformed it. But that's been one of the tricky points, is the philosophy, right, of both. So in Ember data, you're just invoking set on everything. I mean, that's just how it works. That's how the events bubble through the system as you re-render. You never actually create a new state of the system that's a copy minus or plus other attributes, right? You're just always touching a single source of truth. And so I felt like that was always a sticking point. And anyway, Thomas, who did this talk, and I'll point you guys to it, did a great job of saying, like, look, if you're stuck in this world with a lot of Ember data, but you're having some pain points with it, and you want to try Redux to see if this alleviates those by not changing the state, here is kind of a middle ground, which he did, I think, a fabulous job driving it out. Although I must admit, there's got to be some challenges in there just because of the philosophical difference between the two.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely sounds like there's some challenges, but I'm actually pretty eager to go watch that to see what they came up with. I mean, if you're using kind of these snapshot states of your Ember objects, would it be possible then to take all of your, you know, save, delete record, even query, and have them inside of middlewares? So, like, you know, have a Redux saga for every single operation you want to take on the Ember data store.
The example he showed is, yeah, basically the best of both worlds, right? You don't want to ever mutate. So he has a special bit of code to do that. But because the rest of it is vanilla Ember, you could drop in concurrency if you want to do the saga type generator stuff, but you could also just make your changes as you would otherwise. So you use the adapters, you fetch, you save, you delete, whatever you want to do for the most part. It saves a lot on the denormalized side, which you would have to do manually. You don't write any AJAX code, which you have to do manually on the Redux side. So I think there are benefits if someone could get it to work where you're just not changing the state of Ember data, which may actually just be the future of Ember data at some point as well.
Right. So it sounds like there is a pathway forward if that's the way that you want to go and the road that you want to walk. So we'll look for that in the show notes. But my question then is, what you're here on the podcast, what do you do?
Yeah, so I do want to have one disclaimer here, just so that I'm not a complete poser, but I am. I actually don't, if you guys don't know this, I feel like I'm not like trying to hide this from the community, but I don't work on Ember Redux at work. I don't have like a side gig making money with it. I don't use it ever. I literally just build examples, try stuff out. So there's both a blessing and a curse of that, right? The curse is that you're asking, hey, Torin, you're the author. How does this work, man? I can give you my run at it, which I will. But there is the other side, I just want to be very clear, is that, you know, I have not built and shipped Facebook, you know, the current company I'm with, you know, X million people hitting it every month. We're not using it. So this isn't exactly, you know, Torin's stamp of approval here. But I do mess around with, and this week in particular, Rx, which I kind of like. I think Rx is just something that it changes the way you think about the way programming, especially async programming, works. So I definitely cannot comment much on Rx other than I liked Alex's challenge to the community on your podcast saying, go use Rx, even if you use Ember concurrency or don't use Ember concurrency, have it break your brain. It will be for the better. And actually, Jay, I did kind of like a mini code review with me because my first pass at Rx was just using the fetch promise because I was like, oh, I want Rx, right, for side effect modeling, but I want it to still work with Ember acceptance testing because I still feel like Ember is sort of leading in that way, as you guys talked about in a podcast recently. And what was really cool is actually there's kind of a shim that, you know, obviously Rx has its own little AJAX thing, but it is not actually promise based. And the advantage to this that Jay calls out is in the promise base where I'm using Ember fetch, let's say, and I'm just kind of wrapping it with Rx, those promises are still not really cancelable. So what Jay was kind of warning me about is like, hey, if you're just going to use this, you know, quick and dirty, great, but in a real app, these will still queue up in Chrome or IE and block the amount of network requests you can actually make. So don't use promises, even though they're very familiar. Use this sort of operator, I think it is, or a helper inside Rx, which is the AJAX non-promise based operator. So long story short, though, yeah, there's a good amount of work involved that grass is greener, right? So in Ember data, if you've ever used belongs to or has many, you have done the most magical thing right there. And in all the right ways, it is amazing because once you're in Redux and you're like, oh, I have this very nested object graph, but Redux isn't meant to operate on this nested object graph. It's meant to operate on this single tree structure with as many top level entities as I can. So there's a project that's pretty popular in React called Normalizer. And you will likely use this project eventually, maybe not your first Hello World, but you'll use this to actually break apart or truly denormalize the structure. And what that does a lot of times is if you have a blog with comments nested all inside of it from your JSON API call or your GraphQL call, that's fine coming from the network. But since you're going to have different components listening for just the comments, maybe, or different components that just listen and re-render when the blog name changes and they don't care about the comments, you want to actually destructure that. So you have a separate blog top level item and you have a separate comments top level item. and they're still related. So the blog can get to its comments and vice versa as belongs to and has many works in Ember Data, but you've got to do that work now. There's, of course, magical projects like Redux ORM that I just can't speak to how well they work or don't work, but they try and solve the more Ember Data look at the problem, which is, hey, define this and just have the ORM take care of the magic for you. I actually don't mind Normalizer. It's just something people should be aware of because it's more work. You've got to break that apart yourself as well, just as much as writing your own network requests, right? You're hopefully not going to duplicate AJAX all over the place, but you will have to do the work that you otherwise do not do in Ember Data for sure.
Right. I mean, it's very interesting. If you look at like the Ember Data internals, it sounds like the Ember Data store is actually structured very similarly to the way you would, you know, structure a Redux store using something like Normalizer, where you have kind of these top level collections and then some mechanism to both declare and then compute the relationships between, you know, these collections of top level objects. But I wanted to go back to your other point too. I just wanted to say this, Torin, is, you know, don't sell yourself short, because you give an incredible amount of time and an incredible amount of support to the community. You're very active in the Ember Redux channel. You know, when problems come up, you think about them, you fix them. Even if you're not actually watering the trees, you know, you're planting the seeds. And I think that's actually great. I think that is a very valuable and necessary role in any community, is to have people who are essentially the Johnny Appleseed of a particular technology, you know, like, so I think you go around and you throw these seeds around and see where they take root. Even if you're not there, you know, you're on to the next shady lane to plant seeds, rather than stay and kind of enjoy the shade and the fruit of the apple trees.
Yeah. And I appreciate your kind words there, because, you know, a couple of years ago I got into open source because, it provides, you know, good branding, good personal branding. It's like, hey, whose project is this? Oh, it's Torin's. Maybe we should hire Torin, right? It just makes you look more attractive from that perspective. It also gives you almost a way to skip out on tough interviews at times. If people are like, hey, is this guy a decent programmer? Let's take a look at his PRs. Let's see how he communicates with other humans online. So it gets rid of some of that. But there is a dark side, right? We don't talk about it because, you know, there is an upside to it, especially for consulting. But the dark side can be time commitment. You know, how much bandwidth do you have outside of your family life, your hobby, if you have one, and any other open source or work related stuff that you already have to do. And for me, this was really sort of an exercise in thought leadery stuff, right? I saw the benefits of this made my Ember better. Even if I wasn't using Redux, it just made the Ember code I wrote at work better. It inspired me to look at different things like Ember concurrency and RX, things that just way out of my comfort zone 2 years ago. So I think those are all the benefits that come with it. But the interesting part is there's got to be some value from it. The juice, is it worth the squeeze? And I think the community we've built and the people using it and the problems we're solving are all definitely worth the squeeze. So
it definitely is. And you can tell from, you know, the vibrancy of that community that a lot of people are experiencing that value from it. And to your point, I think that this is something that is, you know, often lost on people, is that you can actually use a project without actually using it. You know, I think that there might be many people, for example, in the Ember community that have never used React, but are actually, in fact, using it because of the, you know, the wonderful patterns that have come, you know, out, and it's brought to the fore. I had thought about immutability, certainly on the server side, but, you know, I hadn't thought about it really deeply on the client side until a library like React came along and people started talking about it. And so, you know, I would say before we actually started using React, the library, we were using it in thought. And so you touched on that when, you were saying, you know, it's changed the way I think, it's changed the way I code, you know, so even it's changed the way that I do things at work. And so in fact, you're using it in spirit, if not like, you know, the actual structure, but I almost feel like that's more important. It's longer lasting and has a greater impact on you 10 years down the road, or even 5 years down the road, when neither of the technologies that we're actually talking about today are even going to be in wide use.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, the one thing I would call out that people check out, I think Alex mentioned this, or at least you guys talked about it in passing, but definitely sometime this weekend, watch the Simple Made Easy talk by Rich Hickey. It will definitely make you think differently, regardless of the simple side or the easy side that you fall on. Projects, of course, make trade-offs both sides of that, but it is a great talk. And I think especially someone who's been programming 6 months or a year, 2 years, they're going to get huge benefits from it just as much as someone older like myself who's got 10 plus years in the biz. So
Yeah, no, that is a fantastic talk. You know, we need to link to it every single show.
Exactly.
Well, I think that is a fantastic note to end on. So we will wrap it up. That's it from Frontside for this week. We're going to have you back. Obviously, Torin, there's so much that we could cover. We'll have to, you know, 6 months down the road, we'll do part three. But for now, that's it. So thank you, Will. Thank you, Torin, for podcasting with us this morning.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Really appreciate it.
Yep. And everybody else, take care easy, and we'll see you all next week.